Okay, thank you very much for the introduction. I am a programmer. You notice I have the requisite footwear for my profession. That's my credentials, that's it. What I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about Linux itself. Just a few slides before we get into the actual usage part of it. Then I'll talk about the difference between shells and Windows. And I'll focus mostly on, in fact, almost entirely, on the things that are different between a Linux or Unix machine versus a PC or a Mac. I assume that you've already used PCs and Macs extensively. So I'm not going to talk about the graphical environment. I'll talk about the command line environment primarily. Most of that will be about the Linux file system itself and how to get around with files and how to modify them and understand what how they're configured at any given time. And then we'll just talk about various assorted commands. Just kind of went through in the top of my head and put everything in the notes that I think you should know, including a few things that I wish a lot more starting out users knew about their systems. Feel free to interrupt me at any time with questions.
What does it stand for?
Where
does the name come?
Well, actually, we'll kind of get there. That's a legitimate question. In fact, in some ways, that's an important answer too. I pulled these definitions of what Linux is off the net. Let me just read those for a second. Linux is a free, open-source operating system based on Unix. It was originally created by a guy named Linus Torvalds, but with the assistance of developers around the world, and it was developed under the GNU General Public License. And the source code is free for anyone to use. Now, I want you to understand what these various definitions actually mean. And then we'll get into the actual usage part. What is an operating system? Well, at the bottom level, you've got your hardware. You don't care about hardware. You want something to protect you from the hardware and give you access to it. And that's the software. All you really interact with is the software. At the bottom level of the software of an operating system is a kernel. This is a program that's always running. This is what comes up when your computer first comes up. On top of that are various libraries, which are parts of programs, and complete applications, which are complete programs, that access the kernel. So this kernel, in the same way that the software protects the user from the hardware, the kernel protects the applications and the libraries from the hardware. The other thing you need to make a file system, to make an operating system, is to create a file system, a way that you're going to store data on the disk. And that's not shown in this diagram because it's in fact a collusion between all these other pieces of software. All these pieces of software have to have some information in them about how the file system is structured, where you're actually going to put the data on the disk. Source code is the code that we actually write, the text that we actually write a program in. Computers only understand binary instructions, sequences of numbers that mean things like add or move data around, something like that. But programs aren't written in those binary codes. They're written in a higher level language. This is a small example of some C code, and converted into a binary format by a compiler. Most of you are probably already familiar with that. The important thing about this conversion is that it is irreversible. You can't take the output of the compiler, this binary gook, and get back to what a human can read and modify. So if you don't have the source code to a program, you can't modify it. You can deliver, if you're a developer, you can deliver software to your end user in a binary format only, the result to the compiler. You don't have to give them the source code. And that's what's done with normal commercial software like Windows and Office and things like that. Because the user doesn't have access to the source code, they can't modify it. Now, the GNU public license is a legal document that is shipped with all the open source software that you use that defines, actually, the field of open source. There are other open source licenses these days, but the GNU license was really the first. And it stipulates a couple of things. The binaries produced from some code that was written under the GPL can be given to someone or can be sold to someone. But you have to provide them access to the source code. If you wrote your software and you released it under the GPL, you cannot hide the source code from your users. In fact, you can't charge them to get it. You can charge them for the software, the compiled software, but you have to somewhere, even if it's on a website or some other external form, or right there in the package, you have to give them the source code. So they have to be able to get at the human-readable form of the program. And then this stipulation, that modifications to the source code must also be released under the GPL. That means that if I receive the software and decide to make some changes to it, well, if the software were just in the public domain, I can make changes to it and just sell what I had as if it were my own and make a lot of money off of it. That's the difference between the public domain and the GPL. The GPL says if you modify it, you have to give your modifications back to the community, back to the world. You have to release them under the GPL themselves. So you can't just take something, change the logo so that it looks like your company versus the one that originally wrote it, and just resell it. You can't do that. In fact, you can't make any modifications to it that you don't then release. This is a sort of viral license. It infects, I guess this is the right audience to talk about viruses too. It infects your software in a way. I really think that in some ways this is going to be borne out to be one of the most significant inventions of the 20th century, at least in legal, in the legal realm. The idea that everything that's done in this license belongs to the community and cannot be taken away from the community. It belongs to the world. And that means that people want to work on it. So if I spend some of my time in the late hours contributing to an open source project, I know that no one can steal my work, that my work will always be out there available for everybody to use. No one can modify it and then take it as their own. And that any modifications that I make will lead to other people making additional modifications that will also be freely available to everybody. There are other open source licenses, ones that are much more liberal, ones that allow you to hide the source if you want to, so you can use an open source piece of software and then sell the result. You can incorporate it with proprietary software and things like that. But the GNU license really started it all. Well, why did we have the GNU license? Well, there's this little operating system called Unix that was around for a long time. It was originally written in the 70s by Bell Labs, which belonged to AT&T. It was even called AT&T back then. And it was a proprietary operating system. What was unique about Unix was that it was written at a higher level than most operating systems and was able to be moved or ported to a wide range of computers. There are tons of computers, tons of different processors that can run Unix. Before that, most operating systems were written for a particular piece of hardware. Unix itself is a pun on the term Multics, which was another operating system that Bell Labs based Unix on. So Unix is out there. It's Sun, Silicon Graphics, Digital Equipment. A lot of companies had versions of Unix out there. But it was closed source. If you were really, really hooked into things, you could get some access to view the source, but it still didn't belong to you. So a guy by the name of Richard Stallman, who I believe was at Berkeley at the time, invented the GNU license and started the GNU project. GNU stands for GNU is not Unix. That's why it's not new. It's GNU. What they wanted to do, so this is in 1984, so this is at least a solid decade and a half after Unix itself was developed. What they wanted to do was start to write some of the applications in Unix over again without access to the original versions of the program. So these are fully clean. They're available for anybody to copyright in however they wanted to. And they wanted to release them in a free form. So they invented the GNU public license and started the GNU project to start writing all the various pieces of Unix. People working in their basements and spare rooms at the dead of night. Then in, I think, the late 80s, a guy named Andy Tannenbaum wrote a book on how to write a Unix kernel and sort of implemented one in the book. And a student named Linus Torvalds took it upon himself to actually write a brand new Unix kernel, a robust one, based on largely on this book. And he released it under the GPL. So this is many years after the GNU project had started. They'd already developed some of the tools, but they hadn't written the kernel yet. Linus wrote the kernel. And he released it under the GPL. Together, they create something called GNU Linux, and that's really the proper way to refer to Linux, is GNU Linux, because it's, in some ways, the kernel is a small part of the whole package. It's a very important part, but it's a small part. Thousands of developers all over the world have contributed to this, have added into this software, either to the kernel or to additional applications or libraries that run on the kernel. But that kernel protects the rest of your software, protects your operating system from the hardware. So if somebody's got that kernel there, they can start building up the other applications on any of a number of pieces of hardware. So the result is something that's free, or at least the source code is free. Anybody can modify it. All their modifications go back into the same venue as the original software was released, open source. It's still a pain to build everything yourself from what's freely available. So there have been vendors that have started selling versions of Linux. And if you buy a version of Linux from, say, Red Hat or something like that, if you actually buy the disks in a box, you'll see that they have the fully compiled operating system, all the binaries available to you. They've probably written installers to make it easy to install on your machine. Maybe even nice graphical installers that kind of look like Windows when it installs. They may have added some commercial applications. There's a package called Crossover Office that makes it easy to run Microsoft Office on Linux. And that costs about $100, and sometimes packaged in with various Linux distributions. But one of the disks in there, or maybe a couple of them, will actually be the source code to everything that's on the other disks. You may never look at that disk. Just because you can modify the source code doesn't mean you will. But because it's out there under the GPL, you know that it will always be out there. There are way too many distributions out there. Some people actually see that as a big problem. But if you're all running the same version of the kernel, the current version of the kernel is 2.6, then software will run on all these different versions of Linux pretty readily. So the major difference between these versions is how they deal with installing software, how the installer for the software, for the operating system itself runs, whether it's just this thing that you have to know a lot about how to use, or a very nice, well-thought-out graphical application, and what else is packaged in with it. So the first really big commercial Linux vendor was Red Hat, and for a long time, every time a release came out, you could pick it up off the network and download it yourself. It was still freely available. And then about a year or two ago, they basically closed off their free version of their operating system. And they only sell their operating system now. You can't get it for free. But they created an offshoot project called Fedora, which is sort of a test bed for testing out new things and is freely available. Another big release out there is SUSE. That's what we use mostly in the AMI lab. They also had a free version and a non-free version, and they went the other way. They just went totally free a few months ago. So their latest release, you just download it. You don't even have to buy the disks. Nopix is an interesting distribution because it runs off of the CD or DVD that you get from them or download. In its default mode, it won't even modify your computer. You just put the CD in, boot off of it. You can play around with Linux as much as you want. Maybe access the Windows file system on your computer if it's got Windows on there. But take the disk out, reboot your machine, you're back into Windows. Matter of fact, overall, the only really tricky thing about installing Linux is on a machine that already has Windows if you want to be able to run both operating systems. If you're willing to wipe out your entire machine, installing any of these operating systems is pretty easy. Debian is a totally free, totally open source package. Doesn't include any closed source software at all. What's really cool about Debian is how easy it is to install software. You just say, there's a command called apt-get. You just say, I want this application, and it installs all the other applications or libraries that one might need. So you can install an entire suite of software with one command. In fact, it's so easy to install software on Debian that it's really hard to install the operating system itself. The idea is that, well, you get someone smart who knows or who's done it before to install the operating system, and then the user can install whatever software they want. You install a very minimal system and build from that. Built on top of that is a new distribution called Ubuntu. Ubuntu went through the trouble of making a nice installer for the operating system itself and providing more of the base packages, the base applications that you'd want, but also making it really easy using the same Debian mechanism to install new software. And that's what's on all the laptops you guys are going to be using. It's currently the number one distribution out there. I'm not sure if it's that great for a server environment like we have, but for a desktop, for a home user, I think it's a really, really good operating system. It's really getting to the point where it can almost replace Windows for most use. Okay. That's all I really wanted to say about Linux itself. I just want you to understand what open source is and where this is all coming from. And partially because I think there's a lot of room for open source in science, in developing and releasing science applications. There are two primary ways of interacting with computers these days. This is the interface that you're all probably already familiar with, the GUI interface. You point at things with a mouse, keyboard for when you're supposed to type at stuff. Information is displayed to you graphically. Predating the GUI or graphical user interface is the command line interface. And this is an example of that here, where your input is text and the output is text. In fact, this is a command line environment running inside a GUI window. A normal Linux machine, and in fact, even your Windows machine, starts out in the command line environment and then loads up the graphical applications, graphical support for the applications as part of the process of booting. So let's talk just a little bit about the graphical environment, and then we'll talk about the command line for the rest of the evening. You're probably already familiar with the Mac or Windows GUI. Under Linux and most versions of Unix, they use what's called the X window system, which came originally out of MIT. It's a bunch of pieces. At the bottom is the X server, which is in some ways kind of analogous to the kernel. And the X server is a piece of software that protects you from the graphics hardware. It's the thing that actually is detecting what the mouse is doing and actually displaying images on the screen. Then there are libraries, pieces of programs, that talk to the X server for doing things like creating menus and higher level stuff, and also just getting the pixels on the screen and figuring out what the input devices are doing. Then there are complete X applications that use the libraries, word processors, drawing programs, so on. These all create a window, but there's another program called the Window Manager that manages all the windows. This is the thing that puts the close button on there, the X that closes the window, the thing that iconifies it or makes the window full screen. All those are called window decorations, and those are added by the window manager. And then on top of that, there are complete suites that have not only all these applications and a window manager packaged together, but also ways for them to communicate with each other and provide a more an environment that's more like the Windows or Mac desktop. The key thing here is that these are all different pieces of software. The X server is just this box that you don't even deal with. It's just the thing that manages your hardware for you. Tons of libraries, tons of applications. The window manager is yours to choose. You might run a window manager that makes it look like Windows. There are Windows managers that make it look like the Mac operating system. And there are window managers that are a bit more creative and take their own approaches to how to manage Windows. There are some that are totally radical, that are much different than anything you've ever used. Most of them are so familiar that you could probably start out using them right away. Sure.
You could.
Well, just because it looks like Windows doesn't mean it's going to run Windows software. It's just the visually looking like Windows. It's not at the software level looking like Windows. So you need an application like either Crossover Office, which costs money, and there's another project called Wine, which is Wine is not an emulator. They love these acronyms, which is an attempt to create the Windows environment at the software level under Linux.
Because I'm just wondering, because you said you can delete Windows and just use Linux.
Well, there are applications available under open source that probably replace everything that you might want to do under Windows. There's full Office suites. This is written not with PowerPoint, but with OpenOffice and Press. You're not looking at PowerPoint here. This is running on a Windows machine, but it's running in open source software that's available.
You can transfer it back the other way.
Yeah, you can transfer it back the other way. It's very easy to go back and forth. And these pieces of software are getting better all the time. They're getting closer and closer to the ideal of being able to read all the Windows file formats and work like Windows applications. I'm not sure it's there yet. I had lots of little problems dealing with this application when I wrote these notes that PowerPoint wouldn't have had. Not that PowerPoint is my favorite application in the world. Some people want the comfort of a vendor. They want to know that there's someone that they can complain to. Either if they're an application developer and they want someone to complain to about how they're developing their applications, or a user someone to complain to about their usage. They want someone that they're paying money to be able to call up and complain at. There's no one that does that for Linux. There are services that will provide support to you for a fee, but there's no central, you know, place to go to.
It's like Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Can't complain to him either.
Yeah. But at the server level, machines that people aren't sitting in front of, Linux is very, very strong. It's the desktop that they are just at the edge of being there. If I were to set up my mom or someone like that with a computer just for word processing and email, things like that, I'd probably set her up with a Linux machine because it's impervious to viruses. You're not going to get all the other what's called malware that you get in the Windows environment. I could set things up for her in a way that would be very easy for her to use. A couple of years ago, I don't think that was true.
Because they have better security, because hackers don't bother with Linux boxes.
Both, and that's an important point, and we'll see that in the Mac operating system too. A lot of the reasons you don't see so many viruses on the Mac operating system is because there aren't that many Macs out there. As soon as there are more Macs out there, people will want to write more viruses for it. So it's kind of what's called security by obscurity. Another issue that's really important when you're talking about these sorts of software is the file formats. Microsoft Word is doc format is a closed format. Good luck trying to read it. If your thesis, if your PhD thesis is sitting in only a Word format, then you better hope that you can always get at a copy of Word for the rest of your life, for the rest of the life of your thesis. We're now seeing governments doing things like mandating open, not necessarily open source, but open formats. The format that this is written in, this presentation file, is open, fully documented. Anybody can implement a program that reads and writes this. Not anybody can read and write a PowerPoint. And in fact, after PowerPoint 97, Microsoft didn't even release a free viewer for PowerPoint. You can't get a free viewer for PowerPoint. If your presentation's in PowerPoint and you don't have PowerPoint, you're screwed. But we're starting to see, I think Massachusetts is actually working on mandating open document formats for everything that's done by the government. Okay. Now, Linux is a multi-user operating system. That means that even on your own machine, it's usually configured for multiple people to be able to log in, perhaps even at the same time. For the laptops you're going to be using, you have an account called Student, and the password is Cryo, C-R-Y-O. There's pretty strong protection from one user to another in a Linux environment. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Most Linux machines boot up with the X server running, and they give you a nice graphical login where you can type in your username, and then they prompt you for a password. But some of them might just give you a text prompt, depending on how the machine, state of the machine, how it was configured, or if you screw around with it enough, how it degrades. So you might get a login colon prompt, and if you're screwing around with the laptops, you might get into that state too. In that case, you log in with the username and password, and then start the X Windows environment by typing start X, carriage return. Once you're in that environment, you use logout. There'll be a menu, a system menu that has a logout option to get you out of it. If you get stuck, and there's also a double-sided handout that you guys will get with the laptop that tells you these sort of things just to remind you how to get in and out and what to do if things go wrong. But you can always kill the X Windows server by pressing Control Alt Backspace at the same time. That'll kill any X Windows applications but won't reboot the whole machine. That's if things get really stuck. So this is what the GNOME desktop, this is the particular desktop that I chose. This is one of these full packages that has not only the window manager, but lots of other tools for things to talk to each other, applications for doing things like changing your settings, like your how you want the mouse to work or your desktop background. All those sort of things are built into GNOME. The other strong competitor to GNOME is called KDE. But I chose GNOME because I think it's cleaner. This is what the desktop looks like. First of all, if you're a Mac user, you got to deal with two buttons on the mouse. I know it's difficult, but yes, you have five fingers altogether. It took Apple a while to figure that one out. In fact, X Windows assumes a three-button mouse, has from the very beginning. So you'll have external mice that come with each of the laptops that has a scroll wheel on it. Pressing the scroll wheel is the third mouse button, the middle mouse button. And I know that some of the applications you'll be using will require you to be able to access the middle mouse button. But the GNOME desktop and most other Linux applications assume only a two-button mouse. And it's like on Windows with the main mouse button, the left mouse button does most of the work. The right mouse button is for selecting the options for something or getting a menu. You'll see elements here that are really like each of the other operating systems, both Mac and PC. Similar to the Mac, GNOME has a menu bar up on the top. But unlike the Mac, each application will also have its own menu bar. It doesn't take over the menus at the top like a Mac does. So that's really just the system menu bar. And there are program menus here. These are all the beginnings of menus, applications, places, and systems. And then there are various icons there for applications. It's real easy to take something off the menu and put its icon up here if you use it a lot. And that's what I did with these two. This is the terminal window, and that's an editor. I'll explain those in a bit. And then there's some system information on the right. This little guy here tells you that there are updates on the Ubuntu site to your operating system. So one of the things that's cool about Ubuntu is it keeps your operating system up to date easily. Don't mess with that, because we've gotten all the applications to work on the software that's installed now. So don't go installing new software. Down at the bottom, this little button here hides all the windows so that you can see the desktop. There's nothing sitting on the desktop, but if you need to, you can do that. And then here, just like on the Windows operating system, you'll see an icon, a bar, for each application that's open, each window that's open. And when you iconify them, they go down to here. You click on it, open them back up. These boxes give you access to four different desktops, four entirely different places where you can work and switch between very quickly. So you just click on one of these, and you'll see little icons representing what windows are on that desktop when you've got them populated. And then down in the lower right-hand corner is a trash can. And you can look at this as you would a normal graphical operating system. There's a GNOME file browser that shows you icons for your folders and files. This is accessible from the Places menu. And I'm sure that if you started us up, you could figure out how to use it pretty quickly. It's not that different from Windows or Mac. But what we were talking about today really is the shell, the command line interface. This is where you type commands and the output is presented also as text. You're actually talking to a program. And in the Unix way of doing things, that can be any of a number of different programs that can provide different environments for you. The most common, these are called shells, the most common shells are the Bourne shell, that's the name of the person that originally wrote it, and the C shell, which is called that because its syntax is similar to the C language. These days, the implementations that you'll find on a Linux machine, Bourne shell used to be called SH, the new one is called Bash, which stands for Born Again Shell. I don't make these up. And then the latest version of the C shell is called the TC shell, which I have no idea what the TC is. T probably stands for the, in the TSRI way of doing things, which I always was taught was, you know, you don't do that. T is in a part of an acronym. But yes, go ahead.
Is that important to know?
It's not really important to know. The shell is a command. You can issue that command and go into another shell. You can get within shells, within shells, within shells. I'm not going to really talk about that, but the metaphor of a shell is actually appropriate. It's a kind of a container. And you can have containers within containers. Yes?
So you can choose to switch and use which shell you want, is that right?
You can. Yes. Yes, it is.
Are there some applications that you can only use in one shell over and over? What's the advantage of using one rather than another? Is it exactly the same sort of language that you use?
The basic commands for running an application from the shell are going to be the same in any shell. But shells also have ways to automate commands. So say write a little loop to say move all the files, you know, to the same file name beginning with ending with .back or something like that. Those programming syntaxes are entirely different between the Bourne shell and the C shell. So if you don't access this sort of thing, you won't notice a difference.
So do people tend to just have one shell that they like to work in?
People tend to have one shell that they use forever and ever. I've used the C shell pretty much for 30 years now, and I can't imagine using the Bourne shell for anything. There are people that are the exact opposite. But these are just for writing scripts. For interactive use, you won't really see much of a difference at all. And in fact, changing the shell, I'm not even certain a normal user can change their own shell on a standard system. I think you may have to get the administrator to do it for you. So we have a way of getting to the command line environment in the GUI world, and that is via an application that does that for us. In this case, it's an application called Terminal. And that's the icon for it. You can have as many of those windows as you want. Each of them is a separate shell. And again, this, the notion of containment applies there. Each of them is a separate little world that you're working in. The shell starts out by prompting you that it's ready. And that prompt looks something like this on most machines. It can be configured any way you want, but it normally begins with the name of the computer, the network name of the computer, and then a serial number. The first one is 1, and then the next time after you type a command, the next one will be 2, and so on. It's called a history number. And then either a colon or percent sign or crosshatch or some other character in a space. And then the cursor indicating that this is where your text is going to appear. Now, this is the command line environment. The rest of this stuff is wrapped around it by the GUI environment. A scroll bar, so you can scroll back. Menus, so that you can modify things. Window manager decoration, so you can iconify it or make it the full-size window or close it, so on and so forth. You type a command. In this case, the command is simply the letter D and a carriage return. And then the output from that command appears in the window, and you get a new prompt when that command is finished running, when that program is finished running. Now, the difference between a command line environment and the graphical environment, in the graphical environment, you look at things and point at them. The command line environment, you've got to know the commands. Or else you just sit there and look at the blinking cursor all day if you don't know what to type. That can be intimidating. It can also be incredibly powerful because you can get a lot more done with a keystroke than you can with the mouse. It is much faster to type, like, I think you could type about 10 or 15 keystrokes in the time it takes you to move the mouse somewhere. And that's just at the machine, at the mechanical level. So this is what a command looks like. The computer provides the prompt, and you type in a sequence of words separated by spaces. The first word is the name of the program you want to run. Following that, all the rest of the words on the line are called the arguments. Some of the arguments will begin with usually a minus sign, and those are options. The rest of the arguments are often file names, though they don't have to be. Now, each program can do whatever it wants with these arguments, so it can create any syntax it wants for the command. But there are conventions. Usually options begin with either a minus sign or two minus signs. One minus sign is usually used for little single letter options like this, and two minus signs are used for longer ones that are full words. Doesn't have to be that way. The person that wrote the application is in control. They can do whatever they want. A lot of applications will understand minus H, or more common these days, dash dash help, to say, I don't know how to use this application. So you just type the name of the command, minus minus help, and it will print out a short message telling you what its various options are. When you're editing commands, when you're typing commands, you can use the up arrow and down arrow keys to scroll through the history of commands you've already typed. So if you want to do a command over again, up arrow carriage return will do the same command that you just executed. And you'll see them scroll. It's very nice. And you can do editing on the command line before you hit return. Computer doesn't execute the command until you hit return. So you can do the left and right arrows, the home key to get you to the beginning, the end to get you to the end, backspace to delete things. There are also a number of shortcuts that you can use. I structured these notes so they could also be a reference for you. So, you know, don't worry about memorizing all this. You may want to look back at this as you're working. But this is read as bang, bang. Exclamation mark, exclamation mark. Does the previous command again. So bang, bang, return. Do the same command you just executed. Bang, star means the arguments from the previous command. So it's very common to do something like view a file and then maybe delete it. So you could say something like the delete command, bang dollar, or bang star, to run the delete command on the same files that you ran this previous command on. Bang dollar sign is just the last argument from the previous line. The command history prints out all the commands that you've typed so far in that shell, and it'll show you their history numbers. You can re-execute a command by number by typing bang in the number.
So
you can.
When you say print, you mean print on a
In the window that you're working in.
Just on
the window that you're working in, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Bang and some characters will re-execute the last command that began with that. So bang M would re-execute the last command that began with M. You can also do a substitution. The up arrow, some text, another up arrow, and some more text will replace the sequence GIF with the sequence PNG in the previous command and execute it again. These are all little things that you can do to quickly re-execute commands and use what you've typed before. The Linux file system, it has a hierarchical file system like you should already be familiar with under Windows and Mac.
Just let me interrupt, Bill. We will have to finish in about 15, 20 minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
No,
we don't. And that's the
speaker. Yes. Yeah, I am running long here, but I'll go through this quickly. What you call folders on the Windows and Mac are called directories under Linux. Same concept. But I'm going to use the word directory because I can't think about Unix-type stuff and use the word folders. My brain doesn't work that way. The very top of the hierarchy is called slash, the forward slash. And the various directories under it can be referred to as slash and that directory name, and then an additional slash to get to the next one, and so on. And then here's some files. So this file, refine.log, in the directory student under the directory home under the top level, can be referred to as slash student slash, excuse me, slash home slash student slash refine.log. That's a unique name that will refer to that file no matter where you are. But the shell keeps track of the directory that you're in, the concept of a current working directory. You can print what working directory you're in with the command pwd, print working directory. And here it prints out home student. You can change directories to a new location with the command cd. So here we change to slash user, usr, it's an abbreviation for user. And then if I print out the working directory, it prints slash user. Notice that when I type this command, number two here, there was no output. It just went right back to the next prompt. This is a motif in Linux and Unix. If the command has no output to tell you, if there are no errors, it will tell you nothing. Nothing is good. No news is good news. If you cd with no arguments, it means go back to my home directory. Every account has a home directory. Yours is called slash home slash student. That has your files in it. And then again, we print the working directory and see that that's where we are. A path name is a sequence of text that specifies a file. There are two types of path names. An absolute path name begins with a slash and lists all the directories from the top of the tree all the way down to the file or directory that you're referring to. No matter what your current working directory is, slash home slash student slash refine.log refers to that file in your home directory uniquely. If you don't have a slash at the beginning, your path name is a relative file name. It's relative to where you are. So if you refer to refine.log and you're in home student, then it's slash home slash student slash refine.log. If you're cd to a different place, then refine.log refers to a file in that location, which may or may not be there. Commands, remember, are a sequence of words separated by spaces. Spaces aren't allowed in file names under Unix. So, if you do have spaces in your file names, maybe you copied your files over from a Windows machine or a Mac or something like that where it is easier to use spaces, you've got to either precede your spaces, each space, with a backslash, or put it in quotes. This is a royal pain. And this is why Unix users do not use spaces in their file names and look down their noses at Mac and Windows users who do put spaces in their file names. This has nothing to do specifically with Linux. It has to do with the command line environment. You're typing commands. How does it know where file name begins and ends? You're not typing into a little box. You're typing a long line of text. So generally avoid spaces. They're just a pain to deal with. Also, file names are case sensitive under Linux. That means that file paper abstract with a lowercase p would be a different file name under Linux. So that's not true under Windows. There are some special codes. Dot dot refers to the directory above where we are. Dot refers to the current directory that we're in. Sometimes you need to be able to say that. Tilde refers to your home directory, whoever you're logged in as. And tilde some username refers to that user's home directory, regardless of who you are. So if I'm in home student and I cd to dot dot, I go up one level and my current working directory, when I do a pwd, is slash home. I can cd to tilde, and so if I'm logged in as student, my current working directory will be home student. Yes. Yes, that will, because student is there. It's a relative path name to where you are now. There are variables called environment variables that are shared by all the applications that run under your shell. They're a way for applications to communicate with each other, really to set options. So you don't really need to worry about how they're set, but I need to talk about a particular environment variable in the next slide. But the command to set them is setenv, and the name of a variable, and the thing you want to set it to print an environment, to print a variable, you say printenv and the name of the variable. Once that's set, any application, if it wants to, could find out what the environment variable log file is set to and use that, maybe as the name of the file to put log information in, to write errors to. The important environment variable that you need to worry about a little bit is called your path. This is a big, long list of directories separated by colons. This isn't even the whole list. I had to trim this to get this on the slide. But this is, if you were to type printenv path on your laptops, you'll see something like this. The first word on the command line is the name of a program. This is how it figures out where that program is. It looks in order in each of these directories for a file of that name and executes that file. So what you get when you type the command volume, for example, depends on what your path is. You can always type the explicit full path name of a command if you had to.
Excuse me.
Yes. That's a shell variable, and they're mirrored. It's kind of they're the same. You set one, and the other one gets set appropriately. That's something that the C shell does, but it's not all shells do that. Installing software often means just copying it onto your machine, adding the directory it's into your path, and maybe setting some environment variables so that the software knows where other files that it needs, like help files, and so on. There are actually three different places a command can come from. A command can be built into the shell. It can be an alias, which is a shorthand that you create. You don't want to type out a long command, you can create an alias for it. Or it can be an actual file, a compiled program sitting somewhere in your machine. And the command which will tell you that. So which cd tells you that cd is built into the shell. D tells you that it's an alias that I've created. Which spider tells you that's a program that's actually under the spider, the directory. So let's start with our first command, ls. Ls is short for list, and it lists the files in the current directory. And here it's doing it in a nice column format for you, showing you all the files. There are a lot of options to ls, a lot of different ways you might want to list your files. A real handy one is minus capital F. What this does is it puts a slash at the end of all directory names. If a file is a plain file, it doesn't put anything after it. If it's a program, it puts a star after it. It's just a way of making the output of ls look more readable. Also, files that begin with a punctuation mark, usually a period, are hidden. They're not normally shown when you do an ls. If you want to see all the files, you add the A flag, the A option. And these single character options can be written either by just saying minus and a bunch of them together, or you could also say something like ls minus a space minus f. Both work. But you'll see here when we list all, we see not only this file called .hidden, but we also see these two, dot is the directory you're in, and dot dot is the directory above. I've created an alias for you called D, which is a handy way of listing directories. And it uses the options FC, I'll explain C later, and the additional minus minus color option. It's one of those long word options. What it does is it colors directories and executable files, programs, differently. Again, making this even more readable. This alias is set in a hidden file called your .cshrc file. And that's also where your path is set. This is just a list of commands, but it's read by the C shell every time it starts up, giving you the same environment every time you run. ls-l gives you a long listing that shows you all the information that you could want to know about a file. Don't worry too much about this total. It's a number that really doesn't make much sense. But this would normally all appear on one line, just kind of wrapped here. And let's... Do I have to stop? Yeah, well, I wasn't planning on it, but I could be. I thought we had to...
Has this been useful for people?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because what we
could do, I thought we were supposed to talk at 8.
Because it's really important. I mean, you have to be able to get around the file system and be able to make directories and things like that. I mean, would you be willing to do something at lunch tomorrow?
Yeah, I can come by at lunch tomorrow.
Okay, would people do that then? You can eat your lunch and then we'll try that.
Pick up that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I haven't given this before. I just wrote this over this week, so I didn't know how long it was going to take me.
I think it was great, and based on the questions and all that, but we really have to stop. Otherwise, we won't get on to the next talk.
Okay.
All right.
All right, we'll pick up with slide 30 tomorrow then. It's not over yet. Don't clap until tomorrow. Just hold your applause. Yeah, just remember how wonderful it was today.